Lecture tape for April 28, 1999. We're at the Battle of Jericho, Joshua chapter 5, verse 13 through chapter 6. Now, the story of the conquest of Jericho is probably one of the most familiar Bible stories to us all. But I'm not sure we always realize the significance of that conquest. By taking Jericho, Israel essentially cut the promised land in half. With Jericho as their city, they now had access to the hill country to the west, as well as the lower Jordan Valley to the south, and we're going to see how they go in and conquer the land from Jericho. But before we get into the battle, let's go back and review just a moment what happened last week. We left off where the Israelites had crossed the Jordan River in a miraculous way. When the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant had stepped into the Jordan River, the waters stopped immediately, and they had backed up 18 miles north at Adam. The priests then walked on dry ground, stood in the center of the Jordan River until all 2 million people crossed over safely in one day. Then, at the command of Joshua, when they stepped out of the Jordan, the waters then returned to flood stage. Well, following the crossing, we saw that Joshua built a memorial to Yahweh there at Gilgal, the place that they set up their camp. This is going to be Israel's base camp now as they prepare to occupy the promised land. We also saw that they participated in two ceremonies, both circumcision and Passover. And with that, now the preparations are complete. The covenant has been renewed and Israel is ready to go to battle and take possession now of the promised land. So let's begin with chapter 5, verse 13. And Joshua goes out to view Jericho, probably to look at the walls and see if there's any weakness at all. He goes alone. And in verse 13, we read, "Now when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand." Apparently, Joshua was deep in thought. Something distracted him, and when he looked up, he finds a man standing there with his sword drawn. He does not question his identity, but what he does is in verse 13. He asks, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" And he replies, "Neither. But as the commander of the Lord's army, I have now come." The warrior says he's on neither side, but identifies himself as commander of Yahweh's army. Now that's very interesting, because by saying he's on neither side, he actually fulfills a promise that God gave to Moses, which was in Exodus 33:14. God said that his presence would go with Israel and he would give them rest. And if you remember back to the first lesson in Joshua, we know rest means peace after a military victory. So what the commander was saying is, "I have come not on your side or the enemy's side, but because of the promise that I made. This is God's battle, not your battle, Joshua." And what does Joshua do? Verse 14, he fell face down to the ground in reverence and asks him, "What message does my Lord have for his servant?" Again, the commander lets Joshua know that God is not an ally, but he's the leader. Joshua called him my Lord. The Lord there is not Yahweh, it's Adonai, recognizing that the commander is over the whole universe, not even just Israel. He controls everything. And as you will find in your handout today, this war is a holy war. It's God's war, and it's against the Amorites just as much as it is for the Israelites. You see, the sins of the Amorites are now full. God had, back in Genesis, talked about this, and they have been given 430 years to turn to God. The time is now up. And when we were in Leviticus, we studied these people. They are exceedingly cruel. They are into bestiality, idol worship, child and infant sacrifice. These are not nice, warm, cozy, friendly type people. And so God is now coming against them in judgment. Israel, on the other hand, is not God's sole army. He actually is going to use Israel. He's going to use angels. And he's going to use the force of nature. And we're going to see all of these as we go through the Old Testament. But Joshua's reaction is immediate. He recognizes the presence of the Lord and asks for direction, ready to obey now his commander in chief. Verse 15, the commander of the Lord's army replies, take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy. And Joshua did so. This reminds us so much of two similar events that I sent you back to in your lesson today. The first was with Jacob. And you remember that story where Jacob wrestled with a man all night. And we know that that was a theophany. That was a pre-incarnate Jesus Christ. And at the end, Jacob's name is changed to Israel. That was the turning point. That was where God began working with Israel. We also saw that with Moses at the burning bush. And we find Moses walking up to that bush and having a conversation, and as you saw in your lesson or reminded today, argues with God about the fact that God's asked him to go and release his nation Israel from Egypt. And Moses says, I really don't want to go. And the conversation continues on, and Moses is called and commissioned by God to go bring his people out. With Joshua now, we find a similar calling, if you will, or commissioning. And yet there's a big difference between Jacob, Moses, and Joshua. Jacob wrestled. Moses argued. Joshua is ready to obey. Well, the commander continues on with his instructions, but there is a change in the name given to him. Look at verse 2 of chapter 6. Then the Lord Yahweh said to Joshua, see, I have delivered Jericho into your hands along with its kings and its fighting men. This is still the same conversation with the commander of the king's army, and yet here he's called Yahweh, and up there he's called the commander of the Lord's army. Who exactly is this man? Well, there are some views out there. One is that he's Michael the archangel who comes to earth and brings messages. The others is that it's just a vision, that there's not really a man there. But most of the commentaries, at least the ones that I read, said, again, it was a theophany. It was a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus, the Son of God, just as it was for Jacob and just as it was for Moses. And I tend to agree with that, and there are four reasons why I do. First off, in 5:14, it says Joshua fell down in reverence, and the Hebrew indicates worshipped him. Joshua has been told by God that he must know God's laws and words and follow every command, and then he will have success. The first of the commands is, thou shalt have no other gods before me. If this had been an angel, the angel would have immediately told Joshua to get up and not allowed him to worship. However, Joshua recognized this as the Lord, and he immediately falls face down, just as Moses did before the Lord, and he reverences, or in other words, worships him, and he is allowed to do this. Secondly, Joshua, like Moses, is told to take his shoes off because he's on holy ground. Gilgal, the camp where Israel is holy ground because the Ark of the Covenant is there. Joshua is at Jericho or near Jericho. This is pagan land. It's the land of idols. There is nothing holy about that ground except for the presence of the commander of the Lord's army. Because he is God, where he is standing is holy. And Joshua again recognizes that and immediately takes his sandals off. The biggest clue is in chapter 6, verse 2, because it actually changes the name from commander of the Lord's army to Yahweh. So that's pretty plain as to who it is. And finally, he gives a promise to Joshua that Jericho will be given to him, just as God had promised. So going back to 6:1, we read that Jericho is shut up tight. Now, we've come across this before when you think back to the story of the spies. When they went into Rahab's house and they were hiding on her roof, the messengers from the king came to Rahab, and it was said that the gates of Jericho were shut up tight. That way it prevented anybody from going out, but also if the spies had already made it back, anybody from invading and coming in. It's also a picture of the hearts of the Amorites. As I said, they'd been given 430 years in which to turn to God. And we know from the story of Rahab in chapter 2 that she knew absolutely everything the God of Israel had done for his people. There should be no doubt as to who the true God was. And yet they had not only shut up their city tight, but they had put physical barriers over their hearts and rejected God. Well, Joshua receives his instructions for breaching Jericho's defense after receiving God's assurance that God would give them victory over Jericho as his gift. Look at verse 3. March around the city once with all the armed men. Do this for 6 days. Have 7 priests carry trumpets of ram's horns in front of the ark. On the 7th day, march around the city 7 times, with the priests blowing the trumpets. When you hear them sound a long blast on the trumpets, have all the people give a loud shout. Then the walls of the city will collapse, and the people will go up, every man straight in. How foolish this seems. I mean, I can't imagine what Israel was thinking. March around with horns and shouts, that's it? And yet God was teaching them that it's not by might nor by power, but by His Spirit that the victories will come. He's also going to teach them that with this victory, as long as they are obedient and fully follow the Lord, they will be invincible. There's a lot of cultural things in this section here, and those inside Jericho knew very clearly these things, and so I want us to know them too, so we don't miss anything. First off, all those sevens. There's 7 priests with 7 trumpets. They march for 7 days. On the 7th day, they march 7 times. The Bible teaches us since the book of Genesis that 7 is a number of completion. If you remember back to creation, God created the earth in 6 days, and on the 7th, He rested. The earth was complete. What it said is this victory, this battle over Jericho will be complete. Nothing will be left undone. The others is that the priests were walking in front of the Ark of the Covenant, blowing the shofar, which is a ram's horn. It says trumpet, but this is not a musical instrument. This is an instrument that was used to announce. What they were doing by announcing before the Ark was the arrival of Israel's king. They marched around Jericho, and they announced to those within the walls of Jericho, the king of Israel has arrived, and he has claimed your city as his own. It would have been just as clear to Jericho as if you and I were marching around there with the American flag and the American army behind us. They would know that this now belongs to the king. Well, going on to the actual capture of Jericho is verses 6 to 15. Everything God told Joshua, then he in turn tells the priest and the warrior. Now, the phrase, they blew the trumpet, is repeated frequently during this section. And its importance is that everything that was done, both the beginning and the ending of the march, as well as the continuing march, everything was directed through the use of these trumpets. What a spectacular sight and sound this must have been. The blowing of the trumpets, the amount of times, is unclear, and even the commentators weren't clear. They weren't sure if this was a continual blowing the entire way around or whether they did it at periodic places. It really doesn't matter. However they did it, they announced and heralded the arrival of the King of Israel. I want you to try to picture this event in your mind. They're camped at Gilgal, which is about a 20-minute walk from Jericho. The sun rises up in the morning. The priests, under the order of Joshua, blow the shofar, and the troops muster. The armed guard, led by the Transjordan tribes, begin to march forward, followed by the 7 priests, the Ark of the Covenant, and then following the other troops, ending with the rear guard and the warriors of Dan. The only sound breaking the stillness of the morning is the 600,000 feet of the warriors that we saw numbered in Numbers 26. I picture them marching in unison, and the sound of the ram's horn announcing their arrival. The advance guard reaches the wall. It begins its march around the perimeter. Now, the city is relatively small, 9 acres at very most. So as they begin their march around, the others are still proceeding to Jericho. And by the time they finish going all the way around the perimeter, the rear guard now is beginning their march. Following this, they would return to camp, and once again, silence would be in the city of Jericho. Can you imagine the terror of the city as this continues day in and day out? When we were talking at the leaders' meeting, one of the leaders said, you know, we've just gone through the high school killings at Columbine, and she says, I imagine that this was probably like those kids that were hiding in the kitchen area or hiding in the rooms off the library, absolutely terrified because they never knew when the gunmen were going to come through that door. And it would be very similar to that situation here. And it continues. And the 7th day arrives, possibly the Sabbath. there was 7 days, so one of the days have to be Sabbath. And I think it was probably the last day, because that's the day of rest. And rest in this context means peace from war. They are going to have peace from war following this day. This time it's different, though. They begin circling once, twice, three times. The people inside are now in a state of extreme panic. When will it end? 4, 5, 6. The seventh time around, when the priest sounded the trumpet blast, Joshua commanded the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city." When the people shout, the walls collapse. They fall in on themselves. And the warriors move straight ahead over the rubble and in and take the city. The victory is complete. God has given Israel its first victory in the Promised Land. Now, you've heard various justifications for this event, just as I have. Most say the fall of Jericho was no miracle at all, but simply a scientific fact. The vibrations of the marching feet, along with the trumpets, caused a weakening in the walls, and then at the shout and the trumpet blast, the earthquake caused the walls to collapse before the Israelites. Well, whether this is the case or not makes no difference, because it's a miracle the same. The walls fell at exactly the moment that God directed it to, and they fell everywhere except Rahab's house. Now, whether God used Israel or whether he used nature or both makes no difference to me, because God gave Israel a great victory that day, and God was the one who received the glory. Now, if you think about it, any time there's a first of something, particularly a first victory, you always want to have some sort of memory or memorial of it. I think about when the Berlin Wall fell. Everybody was scrambling to get a piece of the wall. Well, this is the first victory in the Promised Land, and the warriors would definitely want to have some sort of a memento of this great event that they could pass from generation to generation. But God warns them. Look at verse 17. "The city and all that is in it are to be devoted to the Lord. Only Rahab and the prostitute and all who are with her in her house shall be spared, because she hid the spies. But keep away from the devoted things, so that you will not bring about your own destruction by taking any of them. Otherwise, you will make the camp of Israel liable for destruction and bring trouble on it. All the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron are sacred to the Lord and must go into his treasury." We come to the word devoted again. In Hebrew, that means harem, which is total destruction. This is actually the continuation of the consecration to the Lord we saw in Deuteronomy 13. The people inside the city were being judged for their idolatry. But Jericho itself, the city, was really the first fruit of the Promised Land. It was the first capture that they had. And we know that the first fruit belongs to the Lord. Israel was to give back to God, just as in a burnt offering, the first of what was given in anticipation that he would then give them the rest of the Promised Land, just as he said. In the case of Jericho, it meant the total destruction of the city, and it would remain so forever as a memorial or a symbol of the power of Israel's God to all who would see it. And we find Joshua pronouncing a curse upon the city. Look at verse 26. He says that, "Cursed before the Lord is the man who undertakes to rebuild this city, Jericho. At the cost of his firstborn son will he lay its foundation. At the cost of his youngest will he set up the gates." And that verse assumes that all his sons will die in the process as well. Now, Jericho does remain in rubble until about the 9th century, and we're going to see in 1 Kings 16 that a man named Hiel of Bethel does come and rebuild Jericho, and he does lose his oldest son when he lays the foundation and his youngest when he hangs the gate. Now, although the harem meant total destruction for Jericho, it did not mean that there could be no mercy. God's plan was for the nation. Now, people always have a choice, even people whose wickedness has reached the point of seemingly no return, and we're going to see that a lot as we continue through the Old Testament. And we know there was one such person in Jericho, and that was Rahab. And consequently, her whole family was extended God's mercy. The reason given was because she had shown kindness to the spies in hiding them. And we find Joshua honoring the agreement made by the spies to Rahab. Look at verse 22. Joshua said to the men who had spied out the land, "Go into the prostitute's home and mother and brothers and all who belong to her." They brought out her entire family and put them in a place outside the camp of Israel. Then they burned the whole city and everything in it, but they put the silver, gold, and articles of bronze and iron into the treasury of the Lord's house. But Joshua spared Rahab, the prostitute, with her family and all who belonged to her, because she hid the men Joshua had sent as spies to Jericho, and she lives among the Israelites today. Now the question quite often comes up during these battles, what happens to those that are outside, that are captured in war? How do they come into Israel? And this story really answers it. Rahab and her family were brought to Israel, but they were placed outside the camp. If you remember back to Leviticus, we talked about what was clean and what was unclean. Anything that was unclean, including anyone that had touched death or blood or killed anyone, even in battle, which would mean the warriors, and anybody that had been involved in anything else, had to stay outside of the camp for a variety of time. And during that time, they were to be purified. In this case, all the warriors who had touched death, as well as Rahab and her family, would be outside of the camp for, according to Numbers 31:19, 7 days. It says, "All of you who have killed anyone or touched anyone or is killed must stay outside the camp 7 days. On the third and seventh days, you must purify yourself and your captives." So during this time, they would bathe themselves. They would wash their clothing. Rahab and her family would be taught about the covenant. The men would be circumcised. On the third day, they would be purified with water that has the ashes of the red heifer in it. And on the seventh day, they would be purified with that same water with the ashes of the red heifer. And then they would be considered cleansed. At that point, Rahab and her family would cease to be Canaanites and become part of Israel. They would be Israelites. Well, how important was Rahab's role? I like Bible trivia, so a bit of trivia here. Rahab's rescue is given 86 words, and 102 are given to the destruction of Jericho. So she receives almost as many words regarding her rescue as the victory at Jericho. Rahab had rejected her past associations with the Canaanites and already transferred her loyalty. We saw that with the spies. And verse 25 says, "She lives among the Israelites to this day." Meaning that when this book of Joshua was written, she was still alive and still part of the community. We've also seen when we studied her that she has various references made to her in the New Testament in Hebrews. She's praised for her faith and recognized as righteous, and the same with the book of James. My favorite place, though, is in the book of Matthew, chapter 1, where we find her in the lineage of Jesus Christ. You see, it says she marries Salmon, the prince of Judah, who most feel was one of those spies. And Salmon and Rahab have a son named Boaz. And for those of you that were with us in the study of Ruth, you remember that name, because Boaz marries Ruth, another Gentile, or pagan, if you will, and they become the parents of Jesse, who becomes the parents of David, the king of Israel. And of course, that's the lineage of Jesus Christ. Well, the chapter closes with the words in verse 27, "So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame spread throughout the land." God's presence with Joshua was the reason for his fame. Without God's presence, there would have been no miracles. And God again showed his people and the Canaanites that Joshua was his military commander, but God was still in control. This was the first campaign, and that is considered the most important in ancient Near East. The first battle would essentially establish their leadership. In this case, it would secure respect not only with Israel, but also with the Canaanites. This is actually the first of three campaigns. Jericho and Ai, the chapter we study next week, is the first campaign, and that takes the central ridge, dividing the north and the south. Then they're going to do a southern campaign, which goes into the Amorite country, and they will end then with the northern nations, and then their conquest will be complete. Well, the fall and the capture of Jericho really serve as a warning to all the remaining nations in Canaan. Yahweh is here. The God of Israel is here, and he is serious. He plans to take this land, and he is perfectly capable of doing it. The Battle of Jericho, as I said in the beginning, is a holy war. Only during this period of time are there truly holy wars. They try to say they're holy wars today, and they are not. And let me explain to you why Jericho was a holy war. First off, it was designed, initiated, and commanded by God. The army was led by priests carrying the ark, which was the throne of God. The weapons, trumpets and shouting, the victory, only came by God's intervention. That is a holy war. In this case, because it was the first of the holy wars, the city then was devoted to the Lord, or Hiram, by total destruction. Well, Joshua met the commander of the Lord's army in the beginning of this section today, and he asked whose side he was on. And the commander responded, neither. You see, Joshua wanted the warrior to be on his side. But the warrior said, in essence, it isn't your side, Joshua. This is not your battle. This is God's battle. And you are on God's side. You may be the general of Israel, but God is the commander in chief. And Joshua understood that very clearly and immediately took his direction and obeyed everything God commanded him. And when I was going through this section, you know, it just really hit me. And this time I'm talking directly to me. How often do I go through life and I think I know what God wants and I go out and I try to fight my own battles and then I pray diligently, God bless me, be with me, help me in this situation, when in fact what I should be asking is, God, this is your battle, or what is it that you want me to do? We always want to go to God and tell him how we think it ought to best be done. And yet this tells us so clearly that we need to go to God and say, this is your battle, it's not mine. This is your life, it is not mine. Help me to be your servant, your general, under your command. I give you the right to my life. You are the commander in chief. Give me the direction, and I will carry it out faithfully and fully. Let's pray. Lord, what an exciting chapter as once again we realize how miraculously you took your people in to the promised land, and that first victory was nothing less than a miracle. There is no possible way an army can go in with seven trumpets and the shouts and conquer a fortified city, and yet you did it. God, we've already learned how much circumstances are no obstacle for you. In our lives, they're huge. We see the flooded, raging rivers. We see the fortified walls, and yet you see the outcome. Help us to look to you, Lord. Help us to ask you what direction you want for us, and then look to you for strength, encouragement, and guidance, and keep our eyes off of the circumstances. We love you, Lord. Thank you for these stories. Help us to learn. In Jesus' most precious name. Amen.